Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show by talking with you about beekeeping, and we are lucky to have Robert McKinney with us. He's the president of MJD Apiary in Milwaukee. Robert keeps his own hives. He produces honey and mentors novice beekeepers. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in, wondering how you can start your own beehive, or maybe you have some hives and have questions for Robert about them. Maybe you've got an experience to share. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Robert McKinney, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've got a lot of hives.
Not that many. I think I've had 35 last year.
35? Okay. Yeah. And they're located pretty much around Milwaukee?
They're located in a lot of places. I have some in East Troy, some in Hartford, Mequon, Glendale, east side of Milwaukee, north side of Milwaukee, the Hilton Hotel. Yeah, they're all over.
That's pretty cool. And you actually had a little story. Somebody was Clara Kniper was telling me that you helped a hotel in Milwaukee produce their own honey.
Yeah, the Hilton Hotel in downtown Milwaukee. I approached them about 4 years ago, mm-hmm. and with the idea of having hives on top of the hotel. I didn't know before I talked to them was that they were planning on having rooftop gardens up there because they want to start producing more herbs and things like that for the restaurant. They have two restaurants, the Chop House and the Miller Time Pub. And my idea with the hives for them is that the hives would complete their narrative that they were trying to do. People know that pesticides and things like that kill bees off. So having a hive in your garden, it completes the narrative that your food is clean.
It's a pretty cool idea, and it's been pretty successful with them for sure. Well, here we are in the city. Let's look at it this. What are the requirements of a location?
It depends on municipalities. Each municipality has different rules and guidelines. Some in Milwaukee, you can only have two hives. They have to be 50 feet away from a dwelling. If you go a little farther east to Sherwood, Sherwood allows you to have more hives. If you go a little bit more west, Wauwatosa allows you to have a couple hives, but you have to have your neighbor sign off and give permission saying that it's okay to have the hives. So it depends on the municipality.
Well, what about from the bees' point of view?
Well, from the bees' point of view, as far as things go, raising bees in the city, because a lot of people have gardens, and then you have a lot of parks, so you get more of a mixture of floral mm-hmm. in your honey. And that's very interesting. If you when you get wildflower honey, it's just a mixture of flowers in the area.
Sure.
So say I had hives in Madison. The wildflower honey in Madison would taste different than it would in Milwaukee, because of different flowers. So different flowers contribute to the taste of the honey.
So it's kind of like wine in a way.
It is. It is. I learned something about the grapes. It depends on the soil of the grapes that the mm-hmm. Soil's grown, the grapes are grown in, and that contributes to the flavor of the wine. It's kind of, well, basically, you can turn honey into wine. So, yeah, that's what it is.
There you go. Well, Mary in Mount Horeb, the area of Mount Horeb, has a question or comment. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I've heard a lot about kind of collapse of insect populations, and I see a lot of people planting native plants in their yards to encourage native pollinators. I'm curious about how much competition there is between honeybees, which are non-native, and our native pollinator species.
Yeah,
that's very good that you brought that up. A lot of people don't realize that the European honeybee is not native to the United States, to North America. It was brought to North America in about the 1600s by settlers. Along with that, the settlers also brought some of their native food. So here's the thing. When you plant native flowers and things like that, you are attracting native bees, and some you are attracting the honeybees. But at the same time, there are certain plants that you plant for the natives that the honeybees can't access. Like honeybees don't pollinate tomato plants, but you have bumblebees that pollinate tomato plants. So there, whenever you like Google and you Google food for bees, it usually brings up food for honeybees, because honeybees have such a great PR agent, which is the honey. Our native pollinators, they don't have such a PR agent, but they are very, very excellent pollinators. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to actually look into the species of bee that you want to encourage, mm-hmm. and you look for the food that's specific to them.
Mary, does that help out?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. I'm looking at, you brought in some of your products that look great, and you do have one buckwheat honey, which I presume was in an, the honeybees had to be in an area where buckwheat was grown.
That's correct. Like we were talking earlier about how honey has a different flavor based on the flowers, the buckwheat, when you look at that, and you have cranberry over there as well, cranberry came from cranberry pollination. It has a slight little berry ting to it. But that buckwheat, you look at it, it's darker, it's thicker,
yeah.
It's toastier. The flavor is toastier, it's maltier. So like I said, different types of floral produce different types of flavor. And you think about buckwheat pancakes. It's a heavier, heartier
yeah.
pancake. So, yeah.
And then you've got creamed honey, which I'm not sure everybody is familiar with. It's actually kind of a light gold, but it's mostly white.
Yeah. Creamed honey is very interesting. Creamed honey is the same as just any type of wildflower honey. The thing is that honey is two parts sugar. It's a fructose and sucrose and 16% moisture. So when that moisture starts to evaporate, it turns to solid sugar. A lot of people see that crystallized sugar and that solid sugar, and they think, oh, it's bad. But no, that's perfect. That tells you that that's real honey. That's why honey can last forever. So in order to liquefy that honey, you add heat to it. You make a water bath and make it liquid. But what I've done with that creamed honey is I took that solid crystallized honey and I put it into a mixer and I spend it. I spun it till it got smooth. And what happened was it changes the consistency. It's still honey. It doesn't change anything to it, but it changes so it's a different mouthfeel.
Yeah, it is indeed. And then finally, you've got what you call kitchen honey.
My kitchen honey, yeah. My kitchen honey is an experiment that I actually started last year in March, and that is one of my infused honeys. That's actually infused with a habanero pepper. And it Ooh. Adds a little spice to it. And it's such a versatile honey. A lot of people hear it's infused to habanero. They think it's hot. But I made it so that it adds flavor. So it's a lot of people use honey for cooking. So it just mm-hmm. complements things. I have a dark chocolate candy that I use that kicking honey in. And it complements the dark chocolate and the sea salt.
It sounds wonderful. It sounds wonderful to me. Let's go back a bit and talk about what actually happens in the hives. How and why do the bees produce honey?
Okay. You know, what's interesting is that I don't personally like honey. But what we're talking about now is awesome. It's the science that goes on inside that box that I really love. That's what got me, that's what keeps me going. I've been beekeeping for 13 years. I didn't start selling honey until 5 years ago. Honey is just basically a byproduct for me. For the bees, it's their food. They need that to overwinter. We have 20,000 species of bees worldwide. We have 4,000 native to North America and 500 species that are native to Wisconsin. The European honeybee isn't native here. 70% of our native bees, they winter underground and they hibernate. These don't, what they do is they overwinter. So in the winter, what they do is they huddle to keep warm and they unhinge their wings from their wing muscles and they vibrate. And in order to do that, they need energy. And the sugar from the honey is a carbohydrate, and that gives them the energy they need to keep that hive warm. So inside the hive, it's 80 degrees. Outside the hive, it's negative 20.
That's absolutely amazing. And, you know, the sound is that buzzing sound. Mm-hmm. That's the wings moving, isn't it?
That is their wings. Their wings beat 231 times a second. And what they're doing is, a lot of people think they're angry. No, what they're doing is, when they go out and they collect that nectar and they put it into the cells, and they cap over the cells with wax, they have to dry that so that it thickens, so that it turns into the honey that we eat and that they eat. And so they have to dry it out. So if you have a humidifier, that humidifier is bringing out moisture. Well, they're producing that inside the hive, and that's how they're thickening the honey and drying it out.
You know, I'm thinking way back to when Lee Dreyfus was governor of Wisconsin. I remembered him well because I had a class for him when I was a student at the UW. He was a professor here. And he got in trouble when he was a governor because he made a comment that seemed disparaging, calling honey bee poop.
You know, I hear that so much. It comes out the wrong end. The honey is actually, if you want to be like that, it's actually bee vomit. Bee poop is poop, so they don't, you know, poop is poop. But the thing is, when they go and they collect nectar, honeybees have, do you know how many stomachs they have?
I do not know. They're not like a cow and have four, are they?
Well, cows have one stomach but four chambers.
Yeah, okay.
But honeybees actually have two stomachs. They have a food stomach and they have a honey stomach. And what happens is, when they go out and they collect that nectar, they suck that nectar into that first stomach, that honey stomach, and it mixes with a bunch of enzymes. And when they get back to the hive, the foragers spit the honey into the mouth of another bee, which is called a house bee. And that bee takes that and puts it in their honey stomach. It mixes with enzymes. Same thing with another one, and so on and so forth for a while until they finally spit it into that cell. So, yeah, you're eating, for lack of better words, bee vomit.
But it tastes really good.
Yeah, as far as insect vomit goes, yes, it is the tastiest.
Well, how do you harvest the honey, and how does it need to be processed for us to enjoy?
Well, first of all, we don't process it. You've heard of raw honey.
Yeah.
Raw honey is just honey that comes straight from the hive into the jar. And while I'm talking about that, we'll talk about local honey as well. Mm-hmm. So we know what raw honey is, because when I do markets, I get a lot of people coming, is your honey raw, is your honey local? They don't really understand what those two mean.
Yeah.
So raw honey just means honey that comes straight from the hive into the jar. When I have different variety of honey like you have there, they don't understand that honey in different flavors is also raw, because it's just different places, different flowers. So local honey is with honey within 50 miles of where you live. And they say that you should eat local honey because the idea is that you're developing an immunity to the pollen and nectar, the plants that you're allergic to in your area, because those are the ones that you're going to be sneezing to, and things like that. So when I harvest honey, we pull the frame out of the hive. All the frames are capped with wax. The bees cap it with wax. By the way, wax is a very, very valuable item. Beeswax, it takes 5 to 8 pounds of sugar or honey to make 1 pound of wax.
Wow.
So, so they cover it over with wax. We take a uncapper and we take the first layer of the wax off, which exposes the honey. Then we put it into a centrifuge. It's called an extractor. And we put it in that centrifuge, and it spins it around and throws the honey out. And the honey fills up the tub, and then we drain it and put it straight into a jar. Any honey that you find is processed, that's honey that's had heat to it, or that's honey that's mixed with something. That's not really good honey for you. A lot of people buy the honey because it has the natural antibacterial, antioxidants, and things like that that you want, that are healthy for your body. But anytime you add heat to it, depending on how high the heat goes, say our body temperature, 98.6, once the honey hits that temperature, it starts breaking down at least 200 of those enzymes. The hive is normally kept at about 96 degrees. So if your honey is below 96 or below, it's still raw.
Our guest today, Robert McKinney, president of MJD Apiary in Milwaukee, as we talk with him about beekeeping and honey. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org if you had any experiences yourself with hives and raising bees and making honey. I hope you'll join in, or maybe you're just thinking about starting. Give us a call with your questions. Again, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Robert McKinney. Robert, president of MJD Apiary in Milwaukee. And again, questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, and the email address, ideas at WPR.org. And let's take some calls. Gene in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Gene.
Hi. You were talking that honeybees have specific flowers that they go to and utilize. I'm wondering if gladiolas would be one that would be helpful for bees. And I also want to note that since gladiolas only bloom July through September, is that sufficient if you don't have other flowers readily accessible? Would that work?
Are you trying to attract bees to your garden, or you're just a person who wants to just make sure you have flowers available for bees?
Flowers available for okay. bees, and I'm just wondering okay. if they would be, if gladiolas would work for their honey.
I think Jean likes gladiolas.
I think she does, too. Gladiolas, as far as I know, I have not seen any honeybees around gladiolas, but some of our native bees I have seen around the gladiolas. The thing is, too, that bees go 5 miles in a direction, so maybe you could plant other types of flowers, even if they don't come to your garden. If you're specifically trying to draw certain bees to your garden, you might want to try it like a different type of flower. But I think you're set on gladiolas for yourself.
Yeah, but you'll get some other bees coming, and then I'd just plant some other. What are some other good flowers? Or is it a pretty broad range of flowers?
There is a broad range of flowers. You can plant certain mints. You got me on the spot here. There's a long list of flowers. Clover is a good one. There are like different varieties of clover, crimson clover, yellow clover, white clover, things like that. And those are good things to have, too, on your lawn.
Mm-hmm.
So
as part of your lawn, for sure. Mm-hmm. There you go, Gene. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Curtis in Milwaukee. Hi, Curtis.
Hey. Oh, appreciate you taking the call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Overwintering bees for insulation value.
Okay.
I have R10 polystyrene.
Okay.
The
pink stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I have R30 on the top.
All right.
And then R10 on the sides, and then I've insulated the base as well.
Okay. What do you have for ventilation? If you're going to add that much insulation on it, you got to remember, bees are experts at HVAC. So they know how to control the heat and the cold inside the hive. It's not the cold that's going to kill the hive. If you've taken care of your bees, done your treatments and everything, they should be able to sustain it. But I do understand why you're using the the insulation. But when you're adding that insulation, you're also going to add moisture into the hive. So you need to make sure you have ventilation. So what are you using for that?
the two holes in the bottom of the vase where the bees come and go.
Okay. If you're going to do that because you have it surrounded with ventilation, you want to make sure you also have top ventilation too. Because remember, heat rises to the top. So when it rises up to the top, if you don't have any ventilation up there, you know what's going to happen? Yeah. You're going to cause a rainstorm inside your hive, and it's going to rain on those bees. And dead bees, wet bees are dead bees. So when you have that insulation on the top, the air is going to come in, and it's going to help the water dissipate.
So put some ventilation on the top. Yeah. There you go, Curtis. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Chris in Watertown. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Two things. Near Neosho, Wisconsin, there's a honey museum that also sells honey.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big place. I just drove past there. I work for a glass company. And then I liked your caller to make a comment about the flavor of honey made from cactus flowers or desert honey. Okay? Those are my two things, okay?
Yeah.
I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you.
I can't really comment on any cactus honey because we don't have cactus here, so that's not something I can comment on. But, yeah, I'm familiar with Honey Acres. A lot of people go there.
To see the museum? Mm-hmm. And what would you have in a museum? Have you been there yet?
I haven't been there, but I've heard a lot of people go there. Actually, one of my supervisor doesn't live too far from there, I guess. But, yeah, I haven't made the trip.
Okay. Perry and Ocado, we'll go to you.
Yes. Is there a shelf life for honey? Does it lose some of the antioxidants over time? And once it crystallizes, what is the best and safest way to get it back to liquid?
Okay. Honey lasts forever because, remember, it's two parts sugar, fructose, and sucrose, so it's sugar. And in order to decrystallize it, you add it to heat. You don't want to add it to direct heat. A lot of people I see have said that they put it in a microwave. That's not what you want to do. You want to make a water bath. So you boil the water, get it hot, get it bubbling, then remove it from the heat, put the jar of honey in there, and after time it'll liquefy again. That's what you want to do to decrystallize it. But over time, I guess like anything, it loses some of its strength, but it still has the same flavor. It still has some of the same things in it that it had to begin with.
All right. There you go, Perry. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Mona in Appleton. Hi, Mona.
Hi there. Yeah, I just wanted to mention I put I have a little espresso machine. It's not anything real expensive, and it makes like a shot of coffee. And I add frothed milk and honey to my coffee. And just listening to what you said about heating it, which I've already been putting it in after I froth the milk. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it seems to kind of get lost, and I don't really taste it so much. So I just kind of put it on the top of the milk. And it's really good. Good way to sweeten other than just sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's you know, a lot of people, when they add it to things like that, you're doing it more for the flavor than for the benefits. So, and it's interesting you say that because I am doing a coffee bean infused honey, actually three of them. So, yeah, it's a lot of people are using that instead of white sugar. So that's a good healthy choice.
And by the way, we've mentioned your site a couple times. How do people find your site? It's at
I'm at www.mjdbees.com.
MJDBees.com. And I've been to the site. It's a pretty site. So, yeah.
Thank you.
With all kinds of good information on it. Mona, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Sean emailed us. As a fellow beekeeper, he's sure you hear a lot of the same questions. He has answered so many questions about people concerned about metal spoons versus wooden spoons for getting honey out of jars. Can you enlighten listeners about metal spoons versus the little corkscrew wooden spoons that we see?
And that's funny. I get that all the time, and I'm like, you know, we do extract the honey in stainless steel metal. So the idea, though, behind that, because I had to do some research on it, the idea behind that is that actually the honey, because it's acidic, it eats away at that metal on that spoon. So when you're dipping a spoon in there for your honey, you're not keeping it in there long enough to do any real damage or anything. So that's where that comes from.
But I do kind of like the wooden curly.
It looks nice.
It looks nice. It's kind of a cool way to get it out of the jar for sure. Oh, man. Bob emailed us. Just curious, Bob is, if honey is still sold in the individual boxes with a 6-inch, 6x6 square of comb honey. Haven't seen it on shelves in grocery stores.
You can find it. I personally don't make it because, like I said, the combed honey is honey in its purest form. You think about it in its natural wrapper. So honey and combed honey is going to taste different than honey in a jar because that honey in that comb has never hit air. So it's going to be a lot sweeter. It's going to have a better taste to it. But the thing is, like I said, because it takes so much sugar, so much time for the bees to make that wax to put that honey in there. And then when you remove that frame and you cut it up and sell it, the bees have to go back to making it again. It's 5 to 8 pounds of sugar. So that's why it's so expensive to find it. And that's why it's so expensive to make it. That's you're going to pay that 6x6 piece. You're going to pay about $20, $25 for it, whereas a 1 pound bottle you might pay $12 to $18 for.
What are the challenges of raising bees in the city?
Neighbors for one. Bees in the city do a little better than they do in rural areas because of the heat island effect. The heat island effect means that, you know, in a city we got more concrete, more asphalt and everything. So it attracts more heat. So it's a little warmer in the cities than it is in the rural areas. Out in the rural areas, I have hives out in East Troy and Hartford. So out in the rural areas, you don't have that wind block like you do with houses and buildings and things like that. And there's no concrete and everything to absorb the heat. But the biggest challenge is, one, the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Two, is the beekeeper themselves. A lot of people decide to get into beekeeping without actually getting any knowledge or getting any training into it. Everybody thinks that they can get a box and throw some bees in it and it's fine, but there is so much that goes on in that box that you need to educate yourself about before even putting that onto your property. It is a serious, serious commitment.
So the bees need a box. So what is a box like?
A box is, it's basically a box and it holds 10 frames. The idea of the box, it's called a Langstroth hive. And it was invented by Reverend Langstroth. Can't remember. Lorenzo Langstroth, that's his name. And the idea is that the box or the hive imitates the inside hollow of a tree. Because you know that bees naturally make their hives inside trees. So this box starts off as one box with 10 frames, and then that box fills up, you add another one to it. So the idea is that the box, to the bees at least, looks like the inside hollow of a tree.
And you add sort of one frame at a time until you get to 10, or do you have them?
No, you start off with 10 frames, all nine right. And 10 frames on the bottom, and then you add more boxes as that first one fills up.
Steve in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. Say, I have a quick question on pollinator habitats. I have a buddy that he's retired, and he turned his entire farm into a pollinator habitat. And I'd like to know your thoughts on them. Are there any pollinator habitats near your apiaries? Are there any advantages, disadvantages? What's the cost to the taxpayer? Can you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. Pollinator habitats are great. The thing is that... we're talking about municipalities again. You can actually do a pollinator habitat in the city. The problem is that most cities have these restrictions where you have to have your grass a certain height and, no weeds and all this stuff and everything. But our native plants aren't as pretty as some of the ornamental plants that you buy. So the problem that you'd run into while you're doing these native habitats, which are native flowers, native grasses, things like that, which are better for your lawn, because native plants, their roots are a lot deeper into the soil, so you won't get as much flooding. If you look at a golf course, which is just grass, those roots aren't that deep, so you get a lot of flooding in that. With native plants, the roots are deeper, so they're going to soak up more water. But so the problem you're going to run into is with the city, because they don't They aren't naturalists, so they don't know the difference between different types of flowers. The way around that is that if you should get a citation or court or whatever, the difference between a weed and a plant is the cost. You paid for those seeds. You paid for those plants. So they're not weeds.
There you go, Steve. Thank you very much for calling. We mentioned the boxes that you need. What other equipment do you need?
First and foremost, any beekeeper, I know you've seen Instagram, I know you've seen all the videos on YouTube, a bee jacket. You need a bee jacket. You need some type of protection. You need that bee jacket. You need gloves. Those are first and foremost things you need. A lot of people aren't allergic to bees, but you can develop an allergy if you get stung too many times. If you have an allergy to shellfish, chances are you may have an allergic reaction to bee stings as well. So you don't want to take that chance. One of the things I tell new beekeepers, too, when they get into beekeeping, tell your doctor that you're getting into beekeeping. They'll give you a prescription for EpiPen. You may not need it, but you never know who's going to be around you that needs that EpiPen. Another thing is a hive tool, which is standard. It's a tool that you use to pull the frames out of the box. Another one is a smoker. A lot of people see the smoker. They think it makes the bees sleepy. What a smoker does in that hive, like I said, I don't like honey, but I love the science. Inside that hive, there's 17 different pheromones that control that hive. One of those pheromones is the attack pheromone. When you get stung, and the stinger that's still inside you, it sets out a pheromone to the other bees to let them know it's a targeting system. Attack here. So that smoker, that smoke does two things. It masks the attack pheromone, so that's the idea. It masks the attack pheromone so that the bees don't sting you. And the second has to deal with genetic memory, which is very awesome. I learned all this stuff from beekeeping. But genetic memory, when the bees think smoke, they think fire. So they think, okay, we have to move someplace. Because remember a few years ago when the bees were on top of the Vatican? I think it was Vatican and there was that fire. Well, when they smell that smoke, they think, okay, we have to move. We have to leave. So the first thing they need to do, they need to get energy to fly. So they gorge themselves on honey. They start opening the honey. They start gorging themselves on honey. And the idea is that once that abdomen is full, because the stinger comes out the butt. So I can say butt, right? Well, I said it twice. So they, when their abdomen's full, they can't bend their abdomen to sting you. So that's the idea. That's the second purpose of it.
Oh, my goodness me. What's the lifespan of a hive?
We're talking about hive or bees, because a hive can last for a long time. But the bees that are born in spring and summer live for 45 days. That's because the foragers, they end up dying because they go back and forth, and they die from exhaustion collecting. But in the fall, winter bees are born. Those bees are the bees that are going to help the hive survive the winter. And if you've taken care of your hive, those bees are going to survive till the spring. And their lifespan is not 45 days, it's 4 to 6 months. Because their job is inside the hive just to keep the hive warm. The queen, genetically, can live for 7 years. But after about 2 years, she just goes downhill laying, and that's due to environment and other things and things like that. But all those things done correctly, you can just keep your hive going and going and going.
So we've mentioned a few times sting, getting stung, and neighbors worried about getting stung. I mean, how big of a, if somebody puts a hive next door to me, which I wouldn't mind, but if I did, I mean, what would you tell me about, oh, I'm going to get stung? What would you say?
I, initially, when I first started and I had the two hives in my backyard and I needed more space, I started setting up hives in other people's backyards in Milwaukee. So I would have to talk to the neighbors and explain to them there's going to be a hive over here and address their questions. And that's one of the questions a lot of people have. They think, oh, bees are here, I'm going to get stung. I had someone who, his neighbor said, that hive's been here. I haven't even seen the bees. The bees are just going to go about their business. The only time that they're going to actually sting you is if you're inside that hive. A bee on a flower or something like that, there's a less likely chance for them to sting you. So the chances of you getting stung, I'm not going to say zero. I'm not going to say non-existent. but they're very low.
What? Oh, by the way, Gina in Montello wondered if you recommend for what do you recommend for smoker materials? Her smoker is her nightmare, and she struggles getting a good smoke stream for the amount of time she needs when checking her hives.
That is a beekeeper problem. I like that. The only time your smoker smokes really good is when you're not using it. Yeah. But what I've done, because beekeeping can be expensive, what I've done is like go to these coffee shops that like Collectivo, stuff like that. They have coffee. They have burlap sacks, and they give them away for free. So you can cut those up and use them. As far as keeping them lit, yeah, like I said, it's you got to keep hitting those bellows when you're using it. But I've had it so many times where when I'm not using it, when I'm done for the day, the smoker stays lit. So it's... There's no answer for that. There's no answer for that.
Well, that could be frustrating. I imagine beekeeping at time can be frustrating. What's your advice for beginners to finding peace when they're working with bees?
You know what? Beekeeping in itself is peaceful. There's a guy who I helped last year who was he's a vet and he had PTSD. And a few years ago, I had worked with some veterans on this too. The whole idea of beekeeping is this. When you're, for PTSD and stress and depression and things like this, the whole thing is when you're inside that hive, it's just you. It's just you. All the rest of the world is shut out. And you're focusing on that task and what you're doing. And you're looking at those bees. And you're just there in the moment. And that's where you find your peace. Of course, you got people next to you who are going to be asking questions like I do all the time, but still, it is a very peaceful thing.
So, MJD Apiary, what's again your website?
www.mjdbees.com.
MJDBees with an S, bees.
Yes. .com.
Right?
Did I right. get it right? You got it right.
Well, I'll tell you what, Robert, it's been a great pleasure talking with you today. Hope we can do this again. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Robert McKinney, our guest. He's president of MJD Apiary in Milwaukee, and he's been doing this for a while now. And he knows a lot. It was fun talking with him about bees and his honey, which I'm sure we'll be sampling in the not-too-distant future. Thanks again, Robert. Appreciate it very much. Coming up, we're going to take a look at improv comedy on this April Fool's Day. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Take a look at improv comedy right now. Improv, it's entertaining, it's surprising a lot of times, and hopefully funny, and there's absolutely no script or rehearsal. We're talking about improv and Milwaukee's very own comedy sports. It's an interactive comedy experience where improvers compete in teams, and we're talking with Mike Kauth, our guest. He started in 1999 at Comedy Sports in Milwaukee, currently works as a full-time improviser and coach, and in addition to Comedy Sports, Mike studied and performed at Improv Olympic in Chicago. He trained at Upright Citizens Brigade in Los Angeles. So Mike brings a lot of experience to this whole thing. And if you're considering starting improv, what are your questions for a coach? He's a coach, so ask away. What does it take to be an improver? Or maybe tell us about the laughs you've had at an improv show, or maybe your own experiences. We'd love to hear them. Number to call is 800 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Mike Kauth, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Larry. This is a great opportunity. Thank you.
Well, I tell you what. Well, it's April Fool's Day. Has anybody tried anything on you yet?
Luckily, not yet. Not yet. The day is young, so we will see.
I was looking for a job. This is when I'm about 21 years old, and somebody had left a message in the office that's in college to call Mr. Bear about a job. And so I tried all day, and the line was busy, and I finally got through about 5:30 in the afternoon, and it was the Vilas Park Zoo. And to call for Mr. Bear. And the guy at the zoo told me, we just take the phone off the hook all day long on April Fool's Day. Oh, man, oh, man. Well, listen, tell us more about comedy sports for people who've never been.
Oh, for sure. So it's, like you were saying, it's competitive improvisational comedy. So if anyone's seen the shows like Whose Line Is It Anyway or Wild and Out, it's similar in form of short form. So we play improv games. We have two teams, and they compete in these different improv games for points and for laughs. We have a referee, and we have different, like, fouls, because comedy sports is an all-ages show. So we make sure that no one is ever offended. If someone goes over the line, they get the frown bag foul, and they have to put a bag over their head and apologize. We have our groaner foul if someone says something that basically, if it's a dad joke, you know. Like I was thinking, listen to the earlier interview, I was thinking, you know, like, what do bees use to comb their hair? It's a honeycomb, right? Oh. If I said that on the playing field, I would get the groan and have to apologize to the audience.
Oh, my, yeah, that'd be a groaner for sure. Well, how did comedy sports, you know, it's been on for going for 40 years in Milwaukee. What's the history on it?
Well, the history started with Dick Chudnow. He was taking an improv class. He used to do shows with Kentucky Fried Theater, which some people might know, like, grew into the Kentucky Fried movie. They did, like, the Naked Gun series of movies, the Airplane series of movies, the Jim Abrams, I'm trying to think, the Zucker Brothers. Yeah. And Dick knew them in Madison, and he followed them out to Los Angeles and was out there for a number of years and got involved with comedy and took an improv class and loved it and ended up coming back to Milwaukee and initiating comedy sports. Just, you know, it was something he had seen theater sports, but that was much more focused on theatrics. More so than, like, kind of the quick comedy as a sport. So he ended up creating comedy sports, and they performed. I think their first show ever was at the Eighth Note at UWM. And ever since then, it's just, you know, they've accrued such a huge audience. We've been such a part of Milwaukee for 40 years now.
Yeah, the legacy, and, you know, a lot of people have gone from there to do other things as well.
Yeah, that's always been a fun thing. A lot of people, probably like the biggest name to come out of the Milwaukee comedy sports was Dan Harmon, who came up through our comedy sports high school leagues in Brown Deer, Wisconsin, and went on to create Rick and Morty, Community. Rob Schraub is someone he collaborated with. He also came up through comedy sports. Eric Price, who was on, like, Mad TV for a bit, and some names that people might not recognize, but they'd recognize their faces, like Dave Tooney and Kurt Scholler, these character actors that have gone out and just, like, utilized improv to make careers. It's we're pretty lucky around here.
You are indeed. And you've got different kinds of matches. You've got the comedy sports matches, which you talked about, where your own, you've got a bunch of professionals that do this all the time. And then there's a rec league.
Yeah, like our rec league is something that is such a great community builder for us. And we just love to see, like, if you come take comedy sports workshops and you go through our workshops, it unlocks kind of this rec league where you can put a team together of people that you've met through the workshops and perform on Thursday nights. And that's fun because it's just, you see people up and coming, you see their growth. It's just such a positive place to grow improv. You know, like you can sharpen your skills because everyone's really supportive. And you get to see these up and coming improvisers. And it's so much fun to be a part of.
I was looking at your website and you had a comment from somebody who's talked about their 15-year-old daughter or son, I forget, buying tickets for the birthday of the younger brother and the family going and just having such a wonderful time there. So it is something that the family can go to.
Yes. Yeah, that's something Dick Chudnow and Bob Orvis are two guys who really started comedy sports. Dick Chudnow initiated, Bob came on board, and he ran for many years, ran like our road shows. And they're both family guys. They're both people who wanted to be able to create some sort of entertainment that the whole family could enjoy, that you can come to. And now where it's just like, oh, we're watching like a kid's show. It's like, no, like the adults and the kids are going to laugh just as hard. It's not just for one or the other. A show that really anybody can come to. And you can bring someone and not worry about if they're going to, you know, be offended one way or the other.
Yeah. And there's food involved, too, or can be, I guess.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's we're lucky with our location here because we have a fully stocked bar, a restaurant attached. So you can come and eat beforehand. You can order things as you watch the show. So it's really a one-stop shop for a great night out.
Yeah, it is indeed. Mike Kauth, our guest today. It's great to have him with us as we talk about comedy sports and improv comedy. Love to have you join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Do you have some favorite improv memories?
Oh, yes. Yeah. There's it's always like, you know, good shows are great. The ones that go a little sideways are the ones you remember. And I remember, and it ended up being a good show. I did a show on a Greyhound bus. that was an interesting one. Because you show up for work and it's like, all right, you're going to go here. And we get there and it's like, okay, like there's four of us. There's two buses. They split us up. And I'm doing improv comedy. I'm performing in the aisle of a bus. It's like a moving bus that's going down the highway. And all right, here we go. And it was a great audience. That was just a very unique opportunity.
I love it. Oh, my gosh. Somebody was wondering, what's the difference between long and short form improv?
Oh, yeah. Like short form improv is more game based. So you kind of have a gimmick to it. Such as like we play a game like forward reverse. So we kind of know the rules going into that game. It's kind of like you're going to do a scene at some point. The referee is going to blow the whistle. And now you have to go backwards. Like the scene is going forward. The whistle blows. All your dialogue and movement go backwards. They blow the whistle again. You now go forward. So you kind of know kind of the rules going in. Long form, you can kind of take your time building more characters. You'll get a suggestion. And it's more scene and character based, where there's not necessarily a built-in gimmick. You're kind of finding what the story is, what the characters are along the way. So I love both. They both are entertaining and fun to do for me. I think short form, if you're just getting into improv, is probably a good way to kind of dip your toes into it. And if you like it, checking out long form.
Okay. Mike Kauth, our guest today. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We had Elizabeth and Sister Bay. I hope you stay with us. And you can join in, too. The number 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Mike Kauth started in 1999 at Comedy Sports Milwaukee. He currently works as a full-time improviser and coach for this, and it's fun talking with him, and we're going to have a whole lot more right after we take a quick look at the news and we find out what else is in store for us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR. We're talking about improv comedy today on the show with our guest, Mike Kauth. Mike started in 1999 at Comedy Sports in Milwaukee, currently works as a full-time improviser and coach. And in addition to Comedy Sports, he studied and performed in Improv Olympic in Chicago and trained at Upright Citizens Brigade in Los Angeles. So, what do you want to know about comedy sports, maybe in its history? What have you enjoyed about improv comedy? Have you been a part of it? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And, Mike, let's take a call from Elizabeth and Sister Bay, who's been waiting a bit. Elizabeth, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, you fellas may know that the founding family of improv, which is Viola Spolin and Paul and Carol Sills, have kept a place up here, a farmhouse in Door County, since the 60s, and have been up here full-time for many years. Now, Viola and Paul have crossed, but Carol is here, and her children and even a grandson have maintained the family legacy and have workshops here in Door County during the summer. So, letting you know, I just looked it up. It's under paulsills.org or .com. I'm not sure. And if anybody's interested, I don't know if they're taking applications for this summer, but certainly there's a newsletter to get on. So I don't know if you know about that connection here in Door County, but they very much had a hand in making this the arts community that it is.
Oh, Elizabeth, thanks so much for calling. Comment, Mike?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, Viola Spolin wrote probably, like, you know, one of the most important books on improv. And, yeah, Paul Sills, like, I know some improvisers who have studied with him, and it has been such an amazing thing. I would say, like, definitely look into that. That would be an amazing opportunity to take those classes and learn improv. Door County is such a beautiful area.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Elizabeth. Appreciate it very much. We got an email from Mr. Bear, or claims to be Mr. Bear. He's taught workshops at Comedy City in Green Bay, so in Brown County, but in Green Bay, for improvisers who had no intention of ever performing on stage. And he says it allowed them to develop confidence in their public speaking skills and have a lot of fun at the same time, and he recommends it to anyone interested.
Oh, that's great. I agree with Mr. Bear. Sometimes people think of, like, taking an improv workshop as just like, oh, it's for people who want to perform, get in front of an audience. We have a lot of people who take our workshops here in Milwaukee with Comedy Sports just to, like, get out of their comfort zone, to try something new, to get better at public speaking. Maybe, like, they have to give presentations at their work. That's one of the things, too, like, we do at Comedy Sports is we'll do team building workshops. We'll go out to, be it schools, be it corporations, whatever whoever needs us to kind of come out there and help team build. But just the basic like workshops that we offer here, it's like I recommend everyone at some point in their life take a improv workshop, because it really, as an adult, like how often do you get to just play? How often do you get to just be silly and have fun with other people looking to be creative? Like step out of your comfort zone. Yet in a workshop, it's a safe zone to try different things and be something you may not be super comfortable with.
Yeah, it really makes a lot of sense. So you guys keep busy.
We do, yeah. Yeah, that's one of the nice things, like being around for as long as we have, just like kind of learning what the community needs, what the surrounding areas need to provide that, just like a smile, a laugh, you know. I always feel like that's such a great thing that we can do. And because it is sort of like comedy for anybody, like it's accessible, I think, you know. It's here, I got this has been burning in the front of my head. I wanted to ask you, do you know what happens to a plant in math class?
What happens to a plant in math class? I do not know what happens to a plant in math class. It gets chlorinated or dechlorinated.
I'll tell you, it grows square roots. Grows square roots. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, Larry. I just sitting on that one for a little bit, and I was like, I can't leave before I tell him that one.
Oh man! Well, you know, improv is kind of like part of my job too, because here I am,
yeah,
250 days a year on a live show, and most of them are they're not really scripted. So if I lose somebody in the middle of the show and suddenly I don't have a guest, I have to improvise.
Yeah. And it's so funny because, like, so many people improvise throughout the day. You know, like, that's what's fun about, like, anytime we do shows for kids, like elementary school or something. And one of the things that's unique with comedy sports is we use a lot of audience volunteers. So we'll get people up out of the audience to help us play a game or provide something. Like, we have a game called Audience Sound Effects, where the audience member provides all the sound effects for a certain, you know, scene. And it's just amazing, like, because kids are always improvising. They're playing. Like, no one hands them a script when they decide they're going to go play or something like that. And it's so fun to see, like, just what they come up with. And it's, you know, the workshops kind of help adults get back in communication with that part of themselves.
Margie in Menominee Falls has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Margie.
Oh, hi there. Haven't thought about comedy sports for a while. I used to belong to Toastmasters International. It's a public speaking group. And we went down as a group and spent time at comedy sports and had a full-day workshop. And we ended up starting a Toastmasters comedy club called Love of Laughter. We learned a lot through comedy sports, and we were able to go to Italian Fest and gave a comedy thing on one of the stages during Italian Fest. And, you know, he gave us a lot of courage for that. And I've even taken my four grandsons for an outing on all their summer birthdays, and I took them all together to the zoo in the morning, and then we went to the afternoon comedy sports group together, and it was just a riot. And I'm especially impressed when comedy sports goes into the high schools to teach kids how to be quick on their feet and feel comfortable giving a talk, talking to people.
Margie,
can't say enough good things about it.
Oh, thank you, Margie. Appreciate it very much. Comment there, Mike. You got to feel good about that.
Yeah, thank you so much, Margie. I really, that's fantastic to hear, and I love that it's like, you know, covering generations, that you can bring the grandkids here and have so much fun, and you yourself getting up there and doing improv. That is fantastic. And actually, hail from Menominee Falls. So even more so, I'm happy to hear that there's other improvisers. I'll have to just start tossing out some yes ands out there and see if I can find Margie.
You said yes ands, and there's that's part of the rules, isn't it? Yes, a response, yes and.
Correct. Yeah, that's like the biggest kind of cornerstone for improvisation is when you're doing a scene, when you're playing a game with people, like you learn that early on that you yes and you agree with what they're saying, what your scene partner is putting down, and you add to it. It's so great because it's like any idea that you put out there can be supported, can be grown upon. So you can't really do anything wrong unless you say, like, no. If someone tosses out an idea of, like, I just bought a new pony and someone says no, you can't build. You can't move forward, you know. So you want to be able to support that. Yeah, it's beautiful. Wow, it's pretty tall for a pony. It's 8 feet, whatever it is, right? You can just start building together. That's one of the most fun things. That's what I love about improv. Like, I respect stand-up a lot. It has made me laugh very much over the years, and some good friends of mine do stand-up, and but it is a completely different beast. And the thing I love about improvisation is you're there with people. You're building together. It really is a team effort.
Well, it is indeed. Donna emailed, wondering if comedy sports, is comedy sports a licensed or copyrighted trademark? And for you guys, comedy sports, there's no S, it's a Z instead of an S on the end of it. And by the way, she comments that their first experience with comedy sports was delightful, family friendly, as you mentioned. However, when her husband's workplace featured comedy sports for a Christmas party, it didn't work out as well, she said. There may have been alcohol involved.
Yeah, like some of our road shows, like when we go to Christmas parties or private events, you never know what that's going to be like. I've been at shows where it's kind of like we're the main focus, like it's like, hey, we've put up a stage. Everyone's got, you know, they just finished dinner. Here's the show. I've done it where it's just like, hey, you guys are going to be in the corner over here while the DJ plays. You know? I was like, oh, okay.
is that a copyrighted trademark? Comedy sports? Your comedy sports?
I believe it is. Yeah, we have comedy sports across the country. We have one in Manchester, over there in the UK. It's one of those things that if people are interested in starting a comedy sports, they can reach out to the Comedy Sports League of America and start initiating that. So yeah, it's one of those things that we have a variety of locations across the country, across the world.
Daryl in Menominee Falls has something for us. Hi, Daryl.
Yeah, hi. This really brings back memories of when my son was in high school. He went to the Milwaukee High School of the Arts, and they had several different shows at Comedy Sports in the Fifth Ward down in Milwaukee, and I used to love going to those. They were a lot of fun, and it was just a great time, and my son was involved in it, and he still likes to be a comedian. When I go to visit him, he's always joking with his children. And I also have a response to your question about what happens to a plant in math class. Okay. Over time, it multiplies.
Oh, good one, Daryl.
Nice.
I like that. Well, that's pretty nice. Well, what about his comments, Mike?
Yeah, I used to be involved with the high school league for a while, and it is such a fun thing to be able to get young people, like, you know, being creative. And something that, again, like the whole family can participate in. Very happy to hear that was a good time, because that's, you know, at the end of the day, like that's the goal. to bring smiles and laughter to people and have something to look forward to, for sure. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Daryl. Appreciate it. Dan emailed us. Wisconsin's northernmost improv group is Lost in the Woods Improv, and it's based in Bayfield. Lost in the Woods Improv in Bayfield. They perform all over northern Wisconsin. You can find them on Facebook and YouTube. So Lost in the Woods. And I'll be in Bayfield in June. I'll have to look it up and see if that improv group is performing while I'm up there. So that's pretty cool. So there are a lot of, I mean, are you aware of the other improv groups around the state, Mike?
Some of them for sure. And, you know, Comedy Sports travels all over Wisconsin. Sometimes we'll dip into northern Illinois. There is a Comedy Sports Chicago, so they have kind of their area. But if we're far enough, if they're far enough away, we can jump down there. And being able to, like, check out – if I'm traveling around, like Comedy City for sure in Green Bay, I have heard of. And it's one of those things, like, I just – support everyone trying to get improv out there and be creative, because it's such a wonderful thing. Like we were saying, like, yes, Comedy Sports is trademarked, but that, you know, improv is all over the world. And if, you know, you can find space to perform, I encourage everybody, like, get out there. Like, if you like it, there's a lot of material out there. If you're not, like, near Milwaukee or near some of these places that have clubs and groups, like, hop on Amazon, find a couple improv books and start reading and put a group together, because there's nothing like it. It's definitely it can feel addicting after a while, getting up in front of people and just, you know, letting your creativity fly.
Have you ever had a chance or a situation where you, and you probably have in all the years you've been doing this, but you're stuck, you really can't think of a, or you make a mistake while on stage? I would think people would be, that would be the biggest fear. Oh, I'm not going to come up with anything, or I'm going to make some kind of mistake.
Yeah, that's what I love about doing improvisation is, like with Comedy Sports, it's, you know, two teams of three. We have a referee. So you're up there with seven people. So if, you know, if for me, like, all of a sudden I get, like, a little tongue-tied or I start tripping on my words or something, somebody else can step up there. If I don't feel like I have an idea, like, someone else can jump in and support me and, you know, help me out of that or lift me up. I've definitely, you know, bombed up there. And the thing with improvisation is there's always going to be, you know, every show ends. You know, so if something's not going quite right, you just got to do your best. You just got to try your best, work through it. Like anything, there's going to be ups and downs. Sometimes it's like, ooh, I'm really on fire right now. And other times it's like, oh, well, that didn't quite work. But pushing through it, being confident, trusting yourself, trusting your scene partners, it's going to get you through it. And that's what I love about short form too, is like doing Comedy Sports. It's like, we're doing a scene. It's going to last 3.5 to 4 minutes. If I didn't quite hit there, I'm going to get another chance in just a moment to attack another game and get up there.
And you have people from the audience typically will throw out what they want the scene to be?
Correct. Yeah. So if we're doing, like I mentioned, like the game forward, reverse, or audience sound effects, if we're about to do that, the referee is in charge of getting all the suggestions from the audience. So they'll ask him something like maybe for like a small business they would like to own, or something like, what's a hobby you'd like to take up? And audience members yell out different things. A referee grabs one of them and then we're off to the races. We got to work that into the game.
And I, you know, thinking, I've laughed the loudest sometimes when somebody has made a mistake or they can't, you know, you get some sort of pleasure out of watching somebody else.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is a great point, Larry, because it's just like, that's the nice thing is an improv audience knows nothing is scripted. Nothing is planned. So if you make a mistake, if you say something like that just, you know, is unexpected, or like you didn't even expect to say it, like we all get to share in that moment. That's what's wonderful about improv, is it's something like it's being created right there in the moment. You're never going to see the same improv show twice. It's always going to be something different. It's always going to be something unique. And I think like that's what's fun about it. You share that with that audience. You know, you're never going to get that same group of people in a room again.
So do you, you know, like for me doing this show, I need to do a lot of reading aside from the show and being up to date on things. And I imagine for, in comedy sports, you have to do the same. Are you sort of knowing trends and what's current and so forth?
Yeah, like we try and keep up as much as possible. Like, I'll be honest, like when I first started, it was a lot easier in 1999, early 2000s. We as, you know, a world, like, just had much more focus kind of what we had shared as far as pop culture and what was in the zeitgeist. Now there's just so much with, like, the internet, different streaming service. There's so much to consume. So it's just trying to stay as current as possible, which is a nice, fun challenge, you know? Like, it gives me something like, I have a niece and two nephews, and it's just like figuring out, okay, from them, like, what's cool? You know, what do people talk about? So it always gives you an in just to like kind of discuss pop culture and just everything going on in the world. It can be tough, but definitely important.
And what about advice for a novice person who wants to take their work maybe to the next level, possibly perform at a place like Comedy Sports?
Yeah, it's one of those things that my friend who's out in Los Angeles now, Dave Tooney, he has what he kind of called like the three A's of improv. And Dave talked about how it's like attendance, ability, and attitude. So you have to put in the time. You have to be someone that people, you know, get along with. And the ability, you know, it's just like the more time you put into it, the better you're going to be. It's like anything. Like, you just got to kind of keep at it. So I would say, like, if you're just starting out, like, find a way, like there's open improv sessions, keep taking workshops, any chance you have, get up in front of people if you're really serious about improvising.
Mike, it's a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it and enjoyed it a lot. Mike Kauth, our guest today, started in 1999 at Comedy Sports and is still there in Milwaukee. We have a link to their website, but if you write in Comedy Sports with a Z and Milwaukee, you're going to find it. Great talking with him. And great to have you listening in. Tomorrow we'll talk with the UW Stout Gymnastics team trip to the national championship and then the Final Four in basketball. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mehler for Wisconsin Public Radio.